This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Thank you very much for joining us today for another live Midrats. And if you're with us live and you have some questions you would like for us to ask during the course of the show, if you go over to the show page and scroll down to the bottom, that's where you'll find the chat room. That's a great place to join in with some of the usual suspects. And if you have a question you would like for us to address to our guest during the course of the show, that would be the best place to do it. And if you have to run off and take care of some business this busy summer, you can always, after the show is done, get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio to catch up on what you missed. Or you can take a shortcut and just subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher. But hey, let's go ahead and move on with the topic of today's show. And we've talked about it a few times over the course of the last year here on Midrats. And today we're going to concentrate on if not the nitty-gritty specifics, a lot of the conditions or the latent causes that brought us to a series of events in Westpac during 2017 that really caused our Navy and those who love and are concerned with it to take a deep, hard look on what's happening, how we managed to have events take place where 17 of our sailors were killed while underway in their racks. And there's a lot of ideas and theories out there about how we got there and how we're responding to it. But there, it didn't happen overnight, and there's layers and layers and multiple reasons that set the conditions that we had the incidents that we had. And to talk about some of those causes and some of the steps that we're taking to mitigate or at least better understand them, I think we have just one of the best people you could have on to talk about it. For the full hour today, our guest is going to be Admiral J.C. Harvey, Jr., United States Navy, retired. Admiral Harvey, he retired from the Navy back in 2012 while the commander of Fleet Forces Command over at Norfolk, Virginia. He served as country in the Navy for 39 years. He specialized in naval nuclear propulsion, surface ship, and carrier strike group operations. Also at Navy manpower management, personnel policy development, and he served in a variety of operational positions at sea as the Navy's chief of naval personnel and also the director of Navy staff immediately prior to commanding U.S. Fleet Forces. Since his retirement, Admiral Harvey has joined the board of directors of the Navy Memorial Foundation, where he currently serves as the chairman of the board and also the director, outside director at A.T. Kearney PSDS. Back in January 2014, he was sworn in as a member of Governor McAuliffe of Virginia's cabinet, where he served as the Commonwealth's Secretary of Veterans and Defense Affairs until the end of August in 2017. After a few months, he joined the Institute of Defense Analysis as the Director of Strategy, Forces, and Resources Division. He is born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, and he's a graduate of Phillips Exeter Academy, the U.S. Naval Academy, and the John F. Kennedy School of Government over at Harvard University. Admiral Harvey, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thank you very much, Sal. It's a pleasure to be with you guys today.
Yes, sir. Really appreciate you taking time to talk with. It really is an incredibly important subject area because it touches on really the core competency and the fundamentals of our Navy, its sailors, its leaders. A lot of times people talk about, you know, holistic approaches. It's been refreshing just in many ways to see some of the responses and the thoughts that have taken place since 2017. And it has been 13 months since the Fitzgerald's collision. And 2 months after the Fitzgerald, we had the incident with the McCain. Between the two of them, we lost 17 sailors. And like my co-host and I, you are retired as well, though we beat you to the punch by a few years. But retirement always gives everybody a certain bit of perspective with how things are, because you're not that close to it. And just as kind of a scene setter, I was wondering, when you, like all the rest of us, read the reports of last summer, and there were other similar related incidents, though a smaller scale, in Westpac in 2017 as well, what were some of your initial thoughts that came to mind as those reports were coming in and as you saw our Navy respond over the course of the last year? How have your views or perspectives or the areas you think are of most interest evolved over that time?
Well, this one, like you said in your intro, Sal, this one is so intense on so many different levels. For all of us who were ever members of a ship's company and went to sea, for those who were in positions of responsibility over ships that were going to sea, And for those who have had the privilege of serving as COs of ships. So there was so many things as the facts kind of came out after the initial collisions. And on one level, I mean, I was pretty familiar with these waters. I had sailed through them as an officer of the deck on the cruiser Bainbridge, both up at Tokyo One and through the Straits of Malacca. And as a commanding officer of the David R. Ray, the transits through the Straits, as the executive officer of the Long Beach, I was the navigator actually going into Tokyo into Yokosuka. So I knew the area. This was something that we as a Navy had been doing for an awfully long time. Sadly, over the years, we have had collisions from a variety of ships, you know, for a variety of reasons. But it was the combination of things as they came out that really, really hit me hard. The number of very disastrous decisions that were made on the ships themselves, you know, including, I believe, by the CO, the chain of command, the watchstanders, any one of which of those decisions, if you break that chain, you know, then perhaps the collision would not have occurred. So internally, you just were wondering, boy, how, you know, the communication between CIC and the bridge, the decisions about when to go to sea and anchor detail and man up all those positions with more experienced people, the issue of who's qualified and what does that qualification mean? And what's the status of my qual program? And what's the status of my watchstanders and their experience? So you had the internal piece on board the ships. And then, as was brought out very well in both the comprehensive report and the strategic review, then you had the scene setter of what had been occurring over time, not just in the Navy writ large, but a concentrated effect in the Seventh Fleet area of operations and the op tempo there versus the ship's ability to get ready to go to sea, and the decisions that were behind that. So you had big Navy, you had fleet, you had three-star fleet commanders, you had strike group commanders, you had 06 ATG commander, a surface force commander who was making decisions in San Diego that contributed to the overall situation, and then the individuals on the spot, the commanding officers of the ship, who are accountable for the training of their crews, for how those ships are operated. All of this coming together was, as the full picture kind of evolved over those first couple of months, it really was, gut-wrenching, I think, quite frankly. I mean, we were all talking to each other, all asking the same questions. whether from a ship level, from a fleet commander level, from a Navy level, you know, what happened, how did it get this way? And then as we, you know, as I think the Navy got after it, CNO and the secretary, and with the investigations that were conducted, both of the individual events and then the broader, the comprehensive view and the strategic review, I think they were able to get a very good picture of what occurred. And they got going on the holding people accountable for the failures that were apparent in how people were doing business.
Well, none of this stuff occurs in a vacuum. And part of the you almost have to go back to when decisions were made about budget, you know, having so few ships to cover so much ocean, having cut various training programs to allow the ships to deploy. That's the combination that struck me as I read all those reports. Is there a place to point the fingers, or is this like, to paraphrase the people who sell real estate, is this a matter of money, 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 and we kind of go from there?
No, I think it manifestly is not just about money. We were able to do this very successfully on an awful lot of Navy ships in times of much more significant budget duress overall. I think if somebody says, well, it's because of sequestration, it's because of the budgets went down. Well, Navy budgets have been going up and down since 1775. It's the decision making that goes into what, when you get your budget and you get your projections, what do you do with that? So I don't think you simply say, well, it's money and give us more money and we'll have fewer collisions. Let me give you a perspective on this. That's very interesting. You had fleet commanders who made decisions in setting up how business was being done just in Seventh Fleet. And you had Seventh Fleet commander who was held accountable and was relieved for cause as the nature of his decisions became public and became known. You had subordinate commanders who were part of that chain of events who were held accountable, and, of course, those on the ships who carried them out. There was a very interesting event that occurred in World War II that I go back to a lot in thinking about all this. Admiral Halsey, in late 1944, sailed the Fifth Fleet right into one of the largest typhoons on record. As a result of that, three destroyers capsized, 146 planes were lost, seven ships were lost to the fleet, sent back home for repairs. An extraordinary toll of damage and death and injury. And Admiral Nimitz, in response to all that, wrote a letter that I think is one of the greatest letters ever written by a fleet commander to the fleet, talking about responsibility, talking about accountability, and how, yes, a fleet commander is not supposed to sail a fleet into a typhoon, but when the people above you make these kinds of mistakes, the kinds of mistakes that were made in Seventh Fleet, when the fleet commander should have said, no, we can no longer do this safely and effectively. We have to have time to train. We have to have time to maintain. We have to have time to do things right, not just do them and hope for the best. Admiral Nimitz took that same tack, and he said, you have to understand that there is no little red light which is going to flash on or off informing commanding officers that from now on that there's a danger situation that they have to be aware of. They have to be aware all the time, and it's always going to come down to the CO. Yes, they've been put in a very difficult situation. They can be put in a difficult situation, but you can't absolve the CO of accountability, ultimate accountability for what happens on that ship. And even if the fleet commander orders you to sail into a typhoon, Nimitz made it clear, Captain, you don't do that. It is on you. If your chain of command fails, it's still on you. So the captains had choices they made about when to set sea and anchor detail. They had choices they made about who's going to get qualified to be an officer of the deck and what's the standard of qualification I'm going to use. They had choices to make about here's how we do business on Fitzgerald and McCain. And these are the standards I expect to be met if you're doing business on my ship. And so it's not a money thing at all. Is there contributors when you don't have money for maintenance and you don't have money to do training in the larger sense? Of course. But ultimately, it is not about the money. It is about the decisions made by individuals in commanders and in command who caused these accidents to occur. And I just don't think you can throw it at the big sky and say, okay, it's all the budgets, it's Congress, it's D.C., it's jointness, it's Goldwater Nichols. No, let's bring it home. Bring it home, gang. We've all been there. It's decisions made at the point of recognizing the conditions you have and then not properly accounting for those conditions.
Yeah, I think for some reason, I don't hear much from the Air Force on the topic, but I do hear from my friends over in the Army, and that's one thing about our Navy culture that we do get right. All the other things off to the side for a moment. Command is command, and that accountability and that tradition we have, it's something that people who've seen it in action, or even those who've seen it from afar in other services, they really do respect. And it's something that I think, like you said, if they tell you to go into a typhoon, well, you know, skipper, it's your boat. Ultimately, it's your call in the end. For some reason, there's always a certain percentage that doesn't see that it's fair. But to quote my dad, life isn't fair, but command
right.
is command.
Don't get me wrong. I don't pretend it's not a difficult position to be in. Okay, I mean it's an incredibly difficult position to be in when you have to sit up and say, "Hey, I've reached my limits. I can no longer carry out this mission or go on this mission." I mean, they should not have ever been put in that position, okay? And I got that, and the Navy held people accountable who put them in that position. But at the end of the day, also, it's their position that they have to sustain, their decisions they have to make.
Talk about people being put in certain circumstances, outside the lifelines of the ship, for the lack of a better phrase, big Navy, big DOD. There are lots of decisions that have to be made. People make certain assumptions. They do a cost-benefit analysis. They're going to, we'll accept more risk in area X because we need to do that in order to achieve Y, and we take Y to be a higher priority, so we'll accept that risk. And those things add up. And I would have the listeners go over to the show page if you haven't seen it already. And there's a graph there, Admiral Harvey, that I'd like for you to comment that I think really describes well these larger issues that are happening in the background, but really do impact everybody down to the undesignated seaman. And that's your maintenance, your external assessments, the ship-wide training, and the manning and training of our sailors, and how those pressures can really push in on the individual units and commands. Talk for a bit about that matrix visual that we have there for the listener to look at.
Sure. I mean, I think like most of the people who will be listening to this, I was asked by a number of folks who have no knowledge whatsoever about the Navy, just how does this happen, with a modern destroyer, with all the tools that are available to it, watch standards, lookouts, how does something like this happen? And so as I was thinking about, okay, how do I answer those questions? And then how do I sort of explain to myself how it occurred? I came up with this box that sort of explains the concept of safe operating margin. Just like when you design a ship, you design it to be able to withstand certain beam winds, certain degree of roll, stresses on the hull, and you build into that ship a lot more margin than that ship will ever face in routine operations. So the concept is the same for a crew. And so I bounded the problem with manning and training of individual sailors. By that I mean I have the complement that I'm supposed to have by the ship's manning document that those sailors are come to me in the right rate and rating, that they've been trained en route, and they have the right experience that I'm supposed to have to operate that ship. So that's manning of the sailors and their individual training. Then when you get to a ship, you put together teams. All of us have been through that. You know, your nav team, damage control team, engineering teams, combat systems, you know, the team that will launch missiles, the gunnery teams. So you do ship-wide training on seamanship and navigation. And so you have to do that training as well. And then you have to do the maintenance. And so you just simply have got to make sure your equipment is working to design specifications and will be there when you need it. And then I think a very important aspect of this that all of you who ever went to refresher training will remember with great fondness, and some kind of external assessment. Somebody comes and looks at you and says, okay, you're okay. Your seamanship team, your nav team, you can do reduced visibility. You know how to drop an anchor. You can moor to a buoy. You have the proper communications between CIC and the bridge, you know, good crew coordination on the bridge, you know, an assessment that, yes, you're good to go. You're safe to operate. You're effective to operate. And so all those four factors constitute, and if you've got all those factors in your favor, you're right in the heart of the envelope, right where you're supposed to be as a ship, as an effective combatant. Now, when you start losing margin, when you aren't manned and trained properly, when external assessments are pro forma, not taking place at all, or just waived off on the basis of other criteria, or you don't get the chance to do the team training, and oh, by the way, you just replaced your navigator and your quartermaster and your lead OS, all of a sudden that team's vastly different than it was the day before they left. And then if you're not getting the maintenance from external sources, then you're trying to do your own maintenance. And that's taking away from the training you're supposed to be doing. Then what's all that mean? You're losing margin. You're losing from that operational sweet spot. And what happened, I think, is all these issues, assessment, ship-wide training, the proper manning by rate and rating experience, and then by maintenance support, you went to the edge. And so Fitzgerald was operating on the edge of their margin, and they didn't know it. And then it didn't take much, a bad decision on the bridge, incompetent decision-making in CIC, collision, and seven sailors die. So this was this insidious, I think the Strategic Review used this sort of this insidious pressure that came up over time that reduced the margin to safety, where reduced your ability to operate effectively. And these ships perhaps were on the edge, you know, they're dancing on the edge of the cliff and they didn't know it. And so when the stress came, there was no backup, there was no relief, and the disasters occurred. So that was kind of my view of how you lost that margin over time, and then not recognized effectively by those commanders or those in command.
Yeah, as an old navigator and CIC officer, was of course a bridge watch officer, I was appalled by the apparent lack of communication between the CIC and the bridge. How much of that is due to the technology that has changed substantially since I last drove a ship, and how much of that was due to just the lack of a team approach to out there in the Seventh Fleet at this time?
I'm sure that dependence on technology is a contributing factor. You know, and one of the problems with these things is you immediately go back to how you did it, either how you did it when you were a CO or when I was being trained. When Lieutenant J.G. Harvey was being trained on board the the USS Bainbridge as a JOD and as a CIC watch officer. And, you know, and obviously back in the Bainbridge in 1977, 78, you were still pretty much in the MoBoards, SPA 25 repeater and your eyeballs, and, you know, you can handle things. And a quartermaster with a paper chart. So I think there was a growing over-reliance on these systems, and Admiral Davison talked about that in the comprehensive review about the multitude of systems, the lack of standardization of how to operate those systems, how to train those systems, and then the issue of crew coordination, you know, which is a big issue on, obviously on aircraft, multi-crew aircraft, the coordination of all that activity with all these systems, these automated navigation systems, collision avoidance, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think that perhaps, again, not being out there today, I think there was this growing dependence on these systems and this belief that, you know, this is where you will get the answer, and a lack of putting your own self into the equation with, you know, the maneuvering board, with looking at the radar, looking outside, correlating lights with what you see and aspect, talking back and forth to combat. There clearly was this, I take away, a tremendous over-reliance and then a loss of competence with respect to the fundamentals, you know, that have been applied going to sea since Noah and the Ark went. I mean, some things just don't change. And I think there was this over-dependence on the technology and this lack of appreciation for the backups, the manual backups that are so effective in helping you out.
Yeah, like I was told with a very aggressive voice once, look out the black window. Sometimes it is the basic things that can get help. The kind of on the opposite side of things, in the graph we mentioned in my previous question, one of the corners of that is op tempo, and that leads into a lot of the pressures that have compromises, additional risk being taken. And I was wondering what your thoughts on how we can alter or adjust COCOM requirements, as those requirements, are, when they're generated, they have forces be apportioned in such a way that it stresses the seams of overcommitting and getting inside of people's training cycles and getting ships in positions where they have people standing watch on ship X when they're actually qualified on ship Y and they have very different systems. Do you see where altering the COCOM requirements, or at least how we react to them, could help at least in that op tempo corner adjust some of those pressures?
Well, I think one of the things, and I think it's happening, I know the CNO has made these points very strongly, and I think you're starting to see the impact on the apportionment of forces. But when you drew all these lines across the world and said, okay, this is the UCOM line, this is the PACOM line, and this is CENTCOM line, and we all get our own ships, and we have to have our own ships apportioned to us, and they can't be apportioned anywhere else. And I've got this thing called a carrier strike group that can move 550 miles in 24 hours and not break a sweat, okay? Naval forces are mobile, and they're generally very self-supporting. And you have to recognize that you can move them across those lines that delineate COCOM boundaries, and the world will not come to an end. And if you take into account the mobility of naval forces, they can cover a wide range of contingencies at the same time. And you just have to recognize that that's why we built these things the way we did. That's why a carrier can go 30 knots for just about indefinitely and arrive ready to go on station for the mission. So I think you are seeing progress on OPTEMPO that takes into account the inherent flexibility and mobility of naval forces writ large, and you don't have to chain them like to a BMD position in a very small box. You don't have to chain them you have to be in the Gulf, and that's all you can do, when perhaps you can do it just as easily from the Eastern Med or from the Red Sea. And in allowing for this flexibility, then more forces can fewer forces can cover, quite frankly, more territory, and you can relieve a lot of that OPTEMPO. And I think that's a direction we're going in that area.
One of the things that also came through in some of these reports was that the loss of situational awareness on behalf of not only the junior officers but of the commanding officers. Is there, other than more training, is there some way that we can enhance the ability of people to learn how to develop situational awareness?
Well, I mean, that just quite frankly, that comes with experience and a culture that values it. You know, it's very interesting. Back when the current CNO took over, he promulgated this design for maritime superiority. And one of the key elements of that was this ability to learn rapidly and to take advantage of what's going on and experience bring that to the fleet, to the situation, as quickly as we possibly could. So this idea of rapid learning is very, very important. But there's also that you learn from experience, and so I think you have to go through a series of steps as a division officer as you qualify and learn your ship and learn what it means to take a ship to sea, and then as a department head, where you have to learn how to train a junior officer. And I think that is something that we didn't give sufficient attention to. The challenge for a new department head training four or five division officers and being a competent watchstander on the bridge and in combat when everyone's focused on the BMD mission. And then as XO and CO, when you have that larger responsibility for training. And so I think you had to have the right amount of experience, which is why I'm so glad. I know there's been a review of the career path. I was disappointed to see that they're going to maintain the COXO fleet up. I thought this was a great opportunity to move beyond that, declare that an experiment whose time had come and gone, and get back to a CO comes in with a fresh set of eyes who's going to take ownership of that ship and everything that's going on it from the get-go on its day one of his command. So, yeah, you can learn situational awareness. I think it really does just come with experience in the right places at the right time for the right amount of time. So there were, to your point, how do you gain bridge situational awareness if you're competing with seven other ensigns for bridge time? If you're competing with an overload of officers for time in CIC, there's only so many people who can do the training. How are you getting that situational awareness if you're learning from someone who doesn't have the proper level of experience? That I think you see that when the result of that, correct me if I'm wrong, Sal, it was a rules of the road test or a basic seamanship navigation test that was administered to a large number of junior officers. Some did very well, a lot more than you would have liked did very poorly, and there's obviously the bell curve of folks in the middle. Well, they were trained by somebody. They were trained by department heads. And so was there an issue with – do we have an issue with department heads? And if you're going to get that experience, do you have the people now who know what they need to know in those positions? So are we down to bare metal? Do we know the true status of the training of the surface fleet, and are all the steps being taken to jack up that training and restore that experiential level to restore that knowledge level to to where it has to be so you can pass on that to a junior officer just starting out.
Yes, sir, you're correct. They did that to a good cadre of junior officers. And my first instinct on that is I said, okay, now let's do it with some lieutenant commanders and commanders, and let's see what results we get. And that had me think of, and I want to go back to a powerful word you used earlier in the show, and that's culture. And a lot of times you look at good cultures elsewhere that maybe could enhance yours if you brought it on board. And the aviation culture is such that whether you're an ensign or whether you are a Navy captain, wing commander, you're going to get your check ride and you're going to do your open book test. You're going to do your closed book NATOPS test, and you're going to get evaluated on a regular basis on how you perform in the aircraft. Also, having strike group commander, you're very familiar with aviators and how that culture is. And also the nuke culture. They are very, to use a polite word, persnickety when it comes to who's qualified and what you're qualified in. And 1 + 1 always equals 2 in bold letters. And even outside our U.S. Navy lifelines, and my data point, the Royal Navy and the Dutch Navy, predating these problems for 2017, those officers, part of their national personality, they were never shy about telling me what they thought were the shortfalls of the U.S. Navy from a seamanship point of view. And, of course, they run their professional programs pretty well. And as a long way for me to come around to my question, when we look at maybe some issues with our culture in the service community, are there some things in other related cultures that you think would be helpful for us to look hard at and adopt and maybe bring on board to make our culture even stronger?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, quite frankly, Sal, I think that's almost, if you read over the comprehensive review and the strategic review, I think this strengthening the culture is probably the most important thing that's going to come out of all this. You know, I mean, we owe those 17 sailors, we owe all our sailors coming out of this stronger than when we went in. And I think the key to that is the cultural strengthening of our community. And I still say our community. I mean, I try to break myself with the habit. I can't do it. I won't do it anymore. It's just the way it is after 39 years, I guess. But I feel it very deeply. And I think you're absolutely right. We do have to look deep into, okay, aspects of how aviators do business. You know, they don't start out on an F-18. You start out on the old T-28, T-34, the T-4, T-45. You work your way up. We have these things called YPs that we could get all our ensigns to for a solid month or 2 months. And just ship handling 101, you know, the principles of a twin screw, twin rudder operation, you know, when you say right full rudder, all head full, it the same effect is going to happen on a much larger ship. You can learn that. The importance of that check ride, you know, when that XO goes back to be a CO, a guy goes into this XO-CO pipeline for an aviation squadron, he goes back to the RAG and gets that check ride and has to demonstrate proficiency the hard way by doing it. There's a lot in the nuclear community, in the submarine community, about the issue of qualification and the standards that are applied to qualification. And that we could learn from, I think, and adopt. Because has the issue of qualification become too much of a rubber stamp thing? You have to get everybody through, and we just lost it. I don't know. I'm not out there now. But I think you're correct in saying we have to go and look at how others do it. I was sitting there last night sort of anticipating we get to this point, and I'd say, you know, I'd go look hard at the Singaporean Navy. I've always had tremendous respect for them, the Japanese Navy. the French and the UK, the Spanish Navy. The end result, all those different navies are, they all have the same goal, a competent mariner, a CO who is extraordinarily competent in their task, in their profession. We can learn from that. You don't necessarily adopt everything. You can kill yourself under the weight of best practices, but you can look and see how do they do it, why do they do it that way, answer those questions, and then how does it apply to us? And indeed, how do we need to change, perhaps, what we have come and developed over time about how we develop our junior officers, how we develop our COs. I think this cross-cultural learning, you know, along the way of the accelerated learning that the CNO talks about, I think that's a really important piece of this. The good news is you got two new fleet commanders at Fleet Forces and PAC Fleet, Admiral Aquilino in PAC Fleet and Admiral Grady at Fleet Forces. You got new people in command everywhere. I think there's a great opportunity to ask these very difficult questions and look ourselves in the eyes as a surface community and say, okay, we've got off track. These things are not right. We need to make them right. And here are some other places that have found the way, and can they be an example for us? So I hope that's a path that we're going down at a flank bell.
Well, I'm interested in the kind of the YP approach, because one of the things that has struck me is that so many people are now afraid that we, or have been afraid, that we live in a zero defect world. Is there a chance with some small ship operations to get our younger officers out there and let them make some mistakes from which they can learn? Is that something we should be looking at? I don't mean making mistakes, but at least not killing the good people because they say like Nimitz ran a ship aground.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important that you get a chance to go out there and do bumper drills on a YP. And just get underway from a pier and come back alongside of you. You can do everything on a YP that you need to do to really illustrate the fundamentals involved. And I would hope that both the reviews, I think, talked about increasing this type of training. But I think, if I were king, I would mandate it that before you go to your first ship, and you were only talking, 250 first class PICSWO, I think, around that at the Naval Academy, and another couple hundred from ROTC. So you got a number of folks you can bring down to the Naval Academy and have them TAD for 30 days and put them through a concentrated ship handling course, just like you do ground school at Pensacola before you ever get in an airplane. And you have a chance to do that right and set these things up at the start of their time, so they're not trying to figure out what does that right full rudder mean when you're on an Arleigh Burke going 25 knots making an approach or getting ready to make an approach, on the oiler. So it is important to start with something, build the fundamentals. Like you went back to a question you asked earlier, that situational awareness. And this is what's going to happen when you give this kind of an order. And what's the impact of the sea state? And what's the impact of the relative winds on how I get on the course for helo ops and roll and pitch? You just got to go out there and get some time with that. And I think we have the ability to do that in a very intelligent way that will bear tremendous benefits for the force.
I was just thinking about that. The Lord has blessed the United States with a lot of things, one of which, when you look at the type of training you're outlining, you mentioned Annapolis, there are a few better places in the world to do that type of training than the Chesapeake Bay. Relatively protected, all the challenges anybody would ever want. The fact that we're not doing that with that beautiful gift of the Chesapeake Bay is just amazing. But let me pull this thread a little bit with you on something that made me a little grumpy last summer when I read it. It was because it literally took place 5 or 6 weeks before the McCain collision. Navy put out an article where, rightfully so, the sailors on the McCain were bragging about their last underway period, how much depot level work they did in addition to all their other maintenance requirements. And nobody is ever bored underway, or shouldn't be. Nobody is ever at a lack of things to do. And just what kept going through my mind was all the additional man hours expended to do those that depot level work, as opposed to having it being done where it was designed to be done. And since, especially you were a kid, and even when I was a kid, the things that we've lost our tenders. A lot of our shore maintenance facilities were part of that peace dividend. We also, there was an article that came out 2 weeks ago about the big crunch to get dry dock time on the West Coast, because there's just simply aren't the assets in place. What do you see that we could do to maybe claw back not just some of the facilities, but some of our approaches towards that depot level maintenance, so our ships, when they are underway, can concentrate on what they are hired to do?
Well, I think you pretty much answered your own question. I mean, if you don't invest in both the workforce, be that the civilian maintenance teams in the home ports, and invest in having the sailors who go and say get a shore tour at a CIMA, who have the right experience to come on board a ship and help you realign that feed pump, you have to invest in that capability. And I think what happened, and I saw this was a huge focus for me and Admiral Kevin McCoy when he was NAVC, as we were trying to rebuild this maintenance capability for the surface force that had just been, for a wide variety of reasons, had just degenerated over, the last 20, 25 years. And so, there was great gains in efficiency, but tremendous losses in effectiveness. And one of the sad facts that it's always hard to teach people about is particularly those who, wear the green eye shades, is you can be superbly efficient at saving all kinds of monies and then be absolutely ineffective when it comes time to carry out the mission. And so we've had this press toward more efficient, loss of, we've combined maintenance activities. We've given away, like you said, we've cut down on the maintenance commands. We've done a lot of things over the years that left us in a very poor position for being able to effectively maintain our ships, to know what maintenance has to be done, to plan that maintenance, to schedule that maintenance, and then to perform it to spec. I mean, we're talking, I've seen a lot of talk about extending ships' lives, 30, 35 years, 40 years. Go back and look at our history and show me a destroyer class that has lasted beyond 25 years. That's hard to do if you aren't committed to the HM&E maintenance, all the stupid pet tricks that you have to do to keep an auxiliary seawater system functional. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, and it can't be done simply by the crew, particularly as the crews have been leaned out over the years. So it was a real witch's brew that came up, and I think one of those, like we talked about earlier, that loss of margin when you didn't get the maintenance support from the shore facilities, the sailors are doing it. That means they're not training. And that means they're not doing the other things they're supposed to be doing to be effective in the mission. So it was a descending spiral, that degradation over time. I think they used the term in the comprehensive review, the strategic review, the normalization of deviation. That became the norm. And we're, and the sailors, of course, were bragging about it, I think that you're referring to, but it was the wrong situation for them to be in. So you have to invest in people who can do the maintenance, places you can do the maintenance, and time for the maintenance to be done properly for these ships to be effective today and to get the service life that they want to out of them in the future. I mean, there's no substitute for that.
Yeah, I always wonder what happened to the destroyer tenders, but that's not my question. The I want to go back to training for a second. I got another question about training, though. A lot of people have been suggesting that, our young officers qualify as third mates under the Merchant Mariners system before they go to sea. You know, and a lot of the people I've served with on active duty were, in fact, and even the reserves, in fact, graduates of the various maritime academies. A lot of them were well experienced at sea. Is there a system where we could, I know a lot of the maritime academies, they spend a semester at sea or a year at sea. Is there a use for that in our system other than these summer cruises, which make up a big part of our training?
Yeah, I don't see that personally. I kind of go back to how the Coast Guard does business with this in mind. And they seem to manage quite nicely with how the curriculum at the Coast Guard Academy, how that flows with their summer training, you know, whether it's when they're all down there on the Eagle learning it the hard way. And I think those lessons stay with them for a pretty long time. And how the Coast Guard, the standards they expect for their deck and operations officers and how that flows through. I think that's a better model for us than saying take a semester on a merchant ship, because quite frankly, I'm not so shot in the butt, to put it politely, with a lot of the merchant ships that I in my time that I've had interactions with. I don't necessarily see that as the be all and the end all for maritime education, and I'm not making light of it. We certainly have to improve. But I would, as part of this cross-cultural thing we talked about, I'd look awfully hard at the Coast Guard model, and because I have just my respect for that organization has grown so much over the years, and how they produce the kind of quality in this area on a very sustained basis over the years, and I think that's a great place for us to take some lessons learned and bring that into our own culture of how we improve how we train and improve how we set our standards for ourselves, improve how we qualify ourselves. I think all that culturally is probably the most important thing out of all this that we have to improve.
Right next to money, of course, is personnel and the priorities and how you set things. And I know you know more than probably you wish you wanted to know about manpower and personnel requirements, but it's always just like the operations for the four deployed naval forces out of Japan and Westpac is, you know, a little bit different in a variety of ways than it is for our other forces. There's also a challenge to get the right manning and the right numbers for our four deployed naval forces. Are there some things you think that we could do from a personnel policy point of view, maybe incentives or other things that we can do that can help that challenge of getting the right people for our four deployed naval forces?
Well, I tell you, this has been just such a huge struggle for as long as we've had a Navy that had four deployed elements to it, whether it was back in the old days in the Med and in Naples and Gaeta and Rota and to Japan and Korea and the Philippines. You open one throttle and open one valve and you disrupt the system somewhere else when you're trying to give priority. I think number one, you have to make sure you got the right distributable inventory. Who is available to be forward deployed? And when you look at all the things that go into the overseas screening process and the people you lose in that, and you lose that one FC2 who's carrying three NECs, and we spent a year training that individual, and that individual can't go because of exceptional family member problem or a financial problem or you name it. You guys have been there. This is a very, very difficult issue that every solution creates a problem somewhere else. If you give a big priority, the FDNF forces will be manned 100%, 100% of the time. Then I will go and find those ships in San Diego and Norfolk that are going to be manned 80% for 80% of the time. If you want to have all the operating ships manned perfectly all the time, it takes more than 100% of the sailors that are ostensibly required by the manning documents. Just the friction of the system accounts for, between 8 and 10%, just losses over the daily operations. And then you have all the other things that occur. A guy fails out of school, or a petty officer gets a medical down, and then she's not able to deploy. So you have to be very careful when you say, we're going to man these particular ships 100%, 100% of the time, because you're going to be eating it somewhere else. So I think what you have to do is get that distributable inventory as high as you can, which means you're fit and fill. You aim for perhaps, let's say, 92% fit and 90% fill. That means that the right sailors 92% of the time and 90% of them on station. Well, maybe you have to go back and say to the N8, okay, we're going to have to go to 100% fit and 100% fill and use that for planning for schools and school availabilities. You have the new ready, relevant learning pitch going on. Maybe that will help us get the right training people sooner, the properly trained people sooner out to the ships. But it is a problem. I don't pretend to have solved it when I was the chief of naval personnel, and I know that it is something that has been with us as long as we've had four deployed ships. Very, very difficult. Not saying you don't do anything about it because it's hard. That's not correct. But I think it requires a higher distributable inventory to begin with, in the correct rate and ratings that will better serve the ships. Four deployed both in Rota and in Sasebo and Yokosuka.
Well, let me ask that question that I started to ask before. What happened to our tenders? When I was on a 40-year-old destroyer, I really liked pulling alongside the tender. They were always extremely useful to us.
Well, I guess we decided we didn't need them. I mean, what else can I say? But I think we found value in hanging on to the two of the submarine tenders, one in Guam and one in Suda Bay. And I think we would find value in, as you look to this LPD-17 and you take a look, and something we did on Ponce, when we recommissioned Ponce, I told him, load it up, go down to all the DPMOs, load it up with all the machine shop gear you can find, lathes, baking ovens, everything. Because I wanted this also to be able to serve the PCs and the mine countermeasure ships when they got over there, be a mini tender. I think there's an opportunity as you look to the future fleet where you're going to see this kind of forward support capability is going to be very, very important. Particularly, if you want to be less predictable and you want to have a more spontaneous flow of forces that Secretary Mattis talks about, well, then you have to be able to support those forces. And I think you can do it when you look at the next generation of hospital ships. They're not going to be like Mercy and Comfort. Again, that hull of the LPD-17 has extraordinary space and weight available to it. And you can use that for all manner of the next generation of communications command ships, next generation of tenders. You can do an awful lot of support on those things with a little bit of imagination. I don't think it would break the bank. I think it's worth considering because I do believe you need more material support for deployed forces, and that would be one way of getting at it.
You're singing my tune. I'll take all of the above for the unsexy but important, as I like to call it. Admiral Harvey, we've reached the end of the hour. God, what a fast hour on a really important topic. I really appreciate you taking time to visit with us to discuss it.
Well, no, I was glad to be with you all. It is sort of a topic of importance that is impossible to overstate for the Navy, for our ability to do the mission, to deter those who would not have us be able to accomplish the mission, and to reassure those who are dependent upon us to do the mission. We've got to get back on track. I think there's a lot going on that's getting us back on track. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done, and I certainly hope that the effort continues. But I'm very grateful for the opportunity to come and talk with you all today.
Our pleasure. And just as a sidebar, I know you're earning an honest living out there, but do you have any plans down the road to put pen to paper, to do any writing? If somebody wanted to look out for what Admiral Harvey might have to say next, is there a place to look, or are you just it'll show up when it shows up?
Well, I haven't received a huge demand signal or something like that. I like every retired guy, I think about this stuff all the time. Back, if you remember, the San Antonio court-martial that I had to convene for the XO, a lot of the same fundamentals were involved that is going to be involved in the coming court-martial of Commander Brennan, I think, on Fitzgerald. So, I think I am honestly employed with a wonderful organization, the Institute of Defense Analyses, but I would like to take some time and put my thoughts down, so maybe you've given me a spur to my activity to do so. So thanks for that.
Well, if nothing else, sir, you can come back on our show anytime you'd like to.
More than the audience can bear, perhaps.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you have a great summer to you and your family, and look forward to the next opportunity to read or talk to you.
Okay, guys. Thanks very much. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later. And thank you very much, everybody who's joined us for another edition of MidRat. And until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way.